Chapter 21. The Rediscovery of XMRV. The results suggest that xenograft approaches commonly used in the study of human cancer promote the evolution of novel retroviruses with pathogenic properties. Dr. Vinay Pathak, in a paper released on March 27, 2013, showing that proteins from the envelope of a mouse leukemia virus create larger cancerous tumors. We found retroviruses in 85% of the sample pools. Again, it is very difficult to know whether or not this is clinically significant or not. And given the previous experience with retroviruses in chronic fatigue, I am going to be very clear in telling you, although I am reporting them in Professor Montoya's samples, neither he nor we have concluded that there is a relationship to disease. Dr. Ian Lipkin, in a public conference call with the Centers for Disease Control on September 10, 2013. In 2009, Mikovits and her team reported finding evidence of XMRV in 67% of her ME/CFS patient cohort, who also had diminished natural killer cell activity and other markers of impaired immunity. In 2010, Drs. Shaixing Lo and Tarvi Alter reported 83% of their cohort of ME/CFS patients showed evidence of mouse leukemia retroviruses. In 2011, Drs. John Coffin and Vinay Pathak suggested that XMRV, or something very similar, had arisen through the passage of prostate cancer samples through mouse tissue between 1992 to 1994 at Case Western University in Ohio. By 2012, the first two papers had been retracted, or their conclusions altered. What had caused the scientific switchback? The studies from the Blood Working Group and Lipkin could not replicate Mikovits's team's original findings. In 2013, Rossetti re-derived the B-cells lines from uncultured frozen materials, and they now contained no XMRV. In 2012, Ian Lipkin had to acknowledge the danger recombinant viruses created in labs might pose. The mouse leukemia viruses and the theory of the possible connection to human disease was now considered dead, or as the journal Nature proclaimed of Lipkin in an article also released on September 18, 2012, entitled "The Scientist Who Put the Nail in XMRV's Coffin," the situation had been contained. Contained seemed a more appropriate word for the lingering mystery. Scientists did not know what drove the abnormal immune response that even Lipkin had admitted witnessing in ME/CFS. The three positive studies reports using Mikovits's antibody test for spleen focus-forming virus still needed to be explained. Judy Mikovits might escape the burning at the stake, but the research community would do the next best thing and try to forget she had ever existed, effectively shunning her. Even the powerful support of Ian Lipkin could do little to bring her back to the field to which she had devoted her life. Lipkin's powers seemed to be restricted to the undiscovery of research, not the resurrection of researchers. The millions who suffered would have to make do with the promise of bright, shiny science in a hazy but amazing future to come, the same life raft they had clung to for decades, rebranded in new packaging. Their salvation might arrive in the form of ultra-low freezers to maintain their samples, deep sequencing, genomics, RNA profiles, immune system modulators, cytokine and chemokine tests, and investigating the microbiome of their digestive tracts. These advances held promise, but where was the urgency, the fast-tracking, seen in other diseases? Nobody would look for the truth of what had happened in 1934 and 1935 at Los Angeles County General Hospital, and sickened nearly 200 doctors and nurses. Nobody would look for the truth of what happened to start the modern epidemic of ME/CFS, which began in 1984 to 1985 in Incline Village, Nevada, where it was first observed by Dan Peterson and Paul Cheney. And nobody would ask why 1 in 50 children in the United States had autism, a condition that was unknown before its description in 1943 by Lee O'Connor, the former Rockefeller Foundation fellow. On November 27, 2012, a glimmering curiosity of a paper was submitted to the journal Retrovirology. It was unusual for a couple reasons. First, it was odd because of the subject matter, XMRV, when it was well known that the editor-in-chief of Retrovirology, Quanti Zhang, did not believe in the value of research involving the XMRV retrovirus, which his journal had led a vigorous campaign against for 3 years since he accepted it was simply a lab creation and had shouted his virulent dismissal at the Leuven conference in Belgium. 2 months had passed since the publication of the Lipkin study and Nature magazine's identification of Lipkin as the man who put the nail in XMRV's coffin. But it seemed this pesky little mouse-human retrovirus wouldn't stay dead and buried. Instead, it reappeared with church mouse quiet in retrovirology, heralding a rebirth. But then, in the awful style of confounding cover-ups, a tragedy also unfolded. Quanti Zhang had recently delivered the October 24, 2012, George Curie lecture at the NIH on cellular transformation by the human T-cell leukemia virus, HTLV-1. On January 27, 2013, a Sunday night, T, as he was called by his friends, chief of the molecular virology section of the National Institute of Infection and Allergic Diseases Laboratory of Molecular Microbiology, would go to his office and inexplicably kill himself. It is almost hard to reconcile his prior dismissal of XMRV with what several of his Asian American scientific colleagues wrote in an admiring obituary when they said that T always kept his curiosity alive and was ready to embrace serendipity. He sounded, in that description, like another potential ally stolen away. Whatever the cause of his suicide, the field of retrovirology looked more and more like a crime scene, from the willful neglect of patients to institutional neglect and malfeasance to mugshots of innocent scientists in respected journals. The overt blood-throwing days of ACT UP had gotten quieter, yet more insidious. The second curious thing about this retrovirology paper was one of its authors, Vinay Patak, who, along with John Coffin, had first promulgated the idea that XMRV was an inadvertent lab creation made sometime between 1992 to 1994 at Case Western University, and thus couldn't be the cause of the modern outbreak of ME/CFS that began in 1984 to 1985. If XMRV was simply a lab creation, what was the interest in studying it? But Patak and his colleagues seemed very interested. As a Christian, Mikovits felt in her soul that God had placed her in the middle of this controversy for a reason, and her faith directed that if she held on to her faith and acted with integrity, she might also understand why. Harvey's actions may have been a long con, but she too felt that she was in the middle of a longer, greater plan, and it would ultimately shake down to its pure meaning. The title of the retrovirology paper was Xenotropic MLV Envelope Proteins Induce Tumor Cells to Secrete Factors that Promote the Formation of Immature Blood Vessels, and it was published on March 27, 2013, 2 months to the day after Zhang's suicide. In the background section of their paper, the authors wrote, XMRV had first been identified in tissue from prostate cancer tumors, and later in the blood of patients with ME/CFS. Those findings were now in dispute, but most parties agreed that the virus itself had evolved as the result of retroviral combination events in human tumor cell lines established through murine xenograft events. Simply stated, when human tissue passed through mouse tissue, some mouse viruses could recombine with human viruses to form new viruses. In the results section of their paper, Paddock and his colleagues observed that when XMRV was injected into mice that had existing tumors, the virus suppressed the differentiation of blood vessels, leading to larger tumors. In the conclusions section, they wrote, "Although it is highly unlikely that either XMRV or B4RV themselves infect humans and are pathogenic, the results suggest that xenograft approaches commonly used in the study of human cancer promote the evolution of novel retroviruses with pathogenic properties." Mikovits read the line, "promote the evolution of novel retroviruses with pathogenic properties," and wanted to cry out, "That's what I've been saying." It brought her immediately back to the November 2006 Human Herpes Virus 6, HHV6, meeting in Barcelona, Spain, where she'd rushed the stage after the presentation of Dan Peterson, showing his ME/CFS subjects with cancers had abnormal T-cell populations. To Mikovits, the data looked like the footprint of an immune-altering retrovirus, just as she said to Gary Owens in Cleveland, November 10, 2009, when he dared call B4RV XMRV2. Indeed, the 2013 paper in Retrovirology, that Dr. Owens was as a co-author on the Paddock paper, reported that phylogenetic tree analyses demonstrated that while B4RV and XMRV share greater similarity to one another than other MLVs, B4RV represents a distinct sequence from that of XMRV. Together, these data show that B4RV is a xenotropic MLV found in a human cell line derived through xenograft experiments in nude mice that is distinct in sequence and proviral origin from XMRV. Mikovits had entered the ME/CFS field because of the elevated rate of certain rare types of cancer among the patients. One, a doctor who treated ME/CFS, had died of just such a highly vascularized and aggressive tumor shortly after she detected high levels of ENV protein in his blood. Now Paddock and Owens showed the envelope proteins of that very virus and its related family members could indeed promote cancer formation. The mouse leukemia-related viruses and the diseases they might cause among the human population were not quite dead. Vasculitis in mice could be caused by XMRV or B4RV, but somehow, despite this fairly damning finding, they concluded that vasculitis in humans could not be. The place from which these viruses had mutated, the course of their evolution, and the path which had led them from mice to humans were still obviously unmapped regions that needed to be explored. An article published in the journal PLOS-1 on March 13, 2013, from researchers at the University of California San Diego School of Medicine about the reversal of autism in a mouse model of the disorder prompted new theories about what might be behind autism and other neuroimmune diseases, including ME/CFS. The approach was called antipurinergic therapy, or APT, and it was based on the theory that cells got stuck in a defensive mode as they suspected some type of invader. In this immune-activated state, the cells failed to communicate with each other. The lead researcher was Robert Navio, MD, PhD, professor of medicine and co-director of the Mitochondrial and Metabolic Disease Center at UC San Diego. Mikovits wondered if he would shortly find himself in trouble or whether he might more successfully navigate the treacherous waters of neuroimmune diseases. From an article on Science Daily on March 13, 2013, discussing the findings, "When cells are exposed to classical forms of danger, such as a virus, infection, or toxic environmental substances, a defense mechanism is activated, Navio explained. This results in changes to metabolism and gene expression, and reduces the communication between neighboring cells. Simply put, when cells stop talking to each other, children stop talking. When Mikovits read the article, she smiled. She had worked with Suriman back in the late 1980s in prostate cancer, looking for treatment for her stepfather. It was not effective against prostate cancer, but maybe that was because the process was too far along. Could Suriman be effective earlier, used at lower doses to prevent the development of cancer? She also had concerns about long-term use of the drug, but there were other compounds that might do the same thing. Mikovits noted the elegant, smooth, and politically inoffensive way the lead researcher, Navio, had framed the issue. When cells are exposed to classical forms of danger, such as a virus, infection, or toxic environmental substances, a defense mechanism is activated. That covered a lot of ground. It also allowed people to skip over the messy middle of what had activated this defense mechanism, such as a retrovirus, and concentrate on bringing relief to patients. Ian Lipkin held a public conference call on September 10, 2013, with the Centers for Disease Control. The subject was his latest research on ME/CFS patients. Lipkin said, "So, again, there seems to be a significant difference in profiles obtained from people who have had the disease for less than 3 years and people who have had the disease for more than 3 years. In what I would call the early group, which is less than 3 years, there seems to be a number of markers suggestive of some sort of allergy aspect. They have increased numbers, typically, of eosinophils in blood, and when we examine their markers from areas, cytokines, we find there are definite differences. I'm not going to talk a great deal about the differences between before 3 years and after 3 years, because we are still working on this." Lipkin then entered into what he hoped would be the main point of his talk and the takeaway from his findings, namely that they had identified a pattern of inflammatory markers that were unique for ME/CFS. "So I will confine my discussion to a number of cytokines and chemokines that are up or down in people who have disease. And again, this is important because I think that we may find that there are drugs which can be used to modulate the levels of cytokines. And while these may not get at the cause of this disease, the primary cause, which I still believe is likely to be an infectious agent, it may give us some insight in ways in which we can manage and decrease some of the disabilities associated with chronic fatigue syndrome." It was an abnormal pattern of cytokines and chemokines, and her dedication to development of therapeutic strategies to modulate cytokines that had first led Mikovits to conclude that a retrovirus might lie at the heart of the disorder. And then Lipkin reported a retroviral finding which was just as robust as the ones Mikovits and the Low and Alter group had described, but it didn't seem he wanted to spend much time discussing the implications. "We found retroviruses in 85% of the sample pools. Again, it is very difficult at this point to know whether or not this is clinically significant or not. And given the previous experience with retroviruses in chronic fatigue, I am going to be very clear in telling you, although I am reporting this at present in Professor Montoya's samples, neither he nor we have concluded that there is a relationship to disease." When Rossetti heard this, he was apoplectic. What gives Lipkin the right to decide that retroviral sequences, which Coffin had been finding since the 1980s, had no relationship to disease? Rossetti screamed. It was nothing but political expediency. The stealth nature of retroviruses was well known, so if they were really doing any kind of virus hunting, they wouldn't be looking only for buffalo on an open plain. A study published in November 2013 in Nature found, interestingly, that HIV uses an invisibility cloak made up of the body's own cells to evade detection. As reported by Andrew Nocte in The Conversation, HIV uses molecules inside host cells in an infected person to avoid alerting the body's innate immune system, IIS, cells and mechanisms that form the first line of defense in our bodies, to its presence. By using the host's own cells to hide, the virus is able to replicate in the body undisturbed. The team was able to identify how the HIV virus used this cloaking tactic, and was then able to look at how the viral invader might be uncloaked. Rossetti wondered what it would take for someone to uncloak the potential role of retroviruses in neuroimmune disease. Just about everyone agreed that taming the cytokine-chemokine storm in ME/CFS patients was probably an important piece of treating the disorder, just as 2010 was dubbed the Year of Inflammation by researchers at the Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections that focused heavily on the role of inflammation in AIDS. But why were they running from the retrovirus in ME/CFS if a year of inflammation could swirl around AIDS and inflammatory markers were clearly noted in ME/CFS? Something was causing the cytokine-chemokine storm. Didn't they want to know what? They were like meteorologists not wanting to figure out why tornadoes spin. When Mikovits later reflected on all that had taken place in the XMRV investigation, she couldn't help but think that her troubles stemmed not from being the first to consider new ideas, but the first to take them to public forums and discuss their broader public health implications. There was clear evidence that others had pondered the same ideas. Chief among them were her most prominent detractors, John Coffin and Jonathan Stoy. In 1995, the two of them had in fact collaborated on a letter to the editor of Nature Medicine entitled The Dangers of Xenotransplantation. Xenotransplantation refers to the growing of tissue of human organ tissue in an animal, then transplanting that organ into a human being. Both Coffin and Stoy were deeply concerned about the possible dangers of such a procedure being done on a regular basis. Their concerns about the risks of xenotransplantation would mirror the fears Mikovits would later express about whether the passaging of human tissue through mice and possibly other animals in the early days of vaccine development had resulted in just such a catastrophe. In the 1995 letter, Coffin and Stoy wrote that, despite the recent enthusiasm for xenotransplantation, they had significant concerns. What about viruses, which might be contained in these tissues? They wrote, "The pathogenicity of these viruses has not been studied. However, since growth of related viruses in immunosuppressed hosts can lead to tumor development, this prospect is somewhat alarming. We suggest that strenuous efforts be made to identify or breed virus-negative donors, and that all protocols for xenotransplantation include specific steps to monitor human recipients for possible infection by retrovirus of donor origin." Science does have the full capacity for reflection, wisdom, and discretion, and in their campaign against xenograft transplants, Coffin and Stoy displayed admirable insight. Viruses, which had adapted themselves to live in mammals, might become especially virulent when transplanted into humans. The fact that the organ transplant recipients would in all likelihood be immune-suppressed as a result of the operation itself, and the immunosuppressant drugs typically given after a transplant, raised the possibility that even relatively harmless viruses might cause extensive harm to such individuals. If Coffin and Stoy were correct in their concerns about the potential for unknown viruses to cross into humans as a result of human organs grown in animal tissue, it's difficult to see much of a distinction between these notions of organ transplants and vaccines prepared in animal cultures, such as mice, and then injected into people. Infants would likely be at special risk for such viruses, as their immune systems are still developing and might react in unexpected ways to such a challenge. The same might be said of the ME/CFS patients, some of whom worked in high-pressure jobs or were extreme athletes and could have put their bodies through novel stressors, others who may have had prior immunosuppression from another factor. But the question remains whether science is willing to look at its own past practices and exhume those that people like Coffin have tried to bury. The question is in many ways a philosophical one, whether any powerful group should be self-policing without significant oversight from independent bodies. From those who have endured the abuse of members of the clergy to the reckless behavior of large financial institutions, it seems that groups whose ambitions and plans are not periodically challenged often find themselves committing mistakes of devastating proportions. And while industrialized nations no longer have the epidemics of polio or yellow fever ravaging their populations, there are other, quieter plagues. Conservative estimates of ME/CFS in our country are more than 1 million individuals, and autism affects 1 in 50 children. At its height, polio affected no more than 1 in 2,000 children, most of whom ultimately recovered, and for that there was a widespread social outcry for a cure. ME/CFS, autism, and other neuroimmune diseases are lingering afflictions, persisting for decades and lifetimes with incurable devastation. These are not ancient diseases, but relatively new denizens of our planet. We have not seen similar outbreaks before. One wonders if the physical plague of these desperately sick individuals is not matched by an equally deadly spiritual plague among the scientific community that dissuades scientists from having a direct, empathic relationship with patients. The larger question is whether the plague feared by Coffin and Stoy has already arrived, whether we fail to see the clever virus which does not kill its host but has learned to live with it. When a disease takes so much from a patient but stops just short of death, how does the medical community respond? And will the scientific community have the courage to answer the question of whether these diseases might be the result of their own creation? Or will those who suffer have to do what one brave ME/CFS patient did, setting up a mattress in a public space and lying on it in protest until someone adequately responds? The final stunning paper in the possible resurrection of the xenotropic murine viruses playing roles in human disease was published by Coffin and Paddock in November 2013. It is entitled Generation of Multiple Replication-Competent Retroviruses Through Recombination Between Pre-XMRV1 and Pre-XMRV2. The abstract read like the nightmare scenario of some science fiction movie, showing that what scientists had believed to be benign carried terrifying risks. In the experiment, they put 2 endogenous mouse leukemia proviruses, pre-XMRV1 and pre-XMRV2, in culture, and waited to see what happened. They found the presence of reverse transcriptase activity at 10 days post-infection indicated the presence of RCRs, retroviruses that can replicate. Population sequencing of proviral DNA indicated that all RCRs contained the GAG and 5'1/2" of POL from pre-XMRV2 and the long terminal repeat, 3'1/2" of POL, including integrase and ENV from pre-XMRV1. It had taken 10 days to create a new retrovirus in those conditions. And what about all the other xenotropic murine leukemia virus-related replication-competent retroviruses that might have been generated by this recombination experiment, beyond the dismissed XMRV? Could they cause a natural history of infection in humans? Could they relate to Lowe and Alter's findings of variant MLVs? There is no evidence of a natural history of infection in humans by these viruses as of yet. However, it would have taken, and will still take, only one. Mikovits's question to Coffin in Ottawa takes on more prescient meaning. How many new recombinant retroviruses have we created? Rossetti thinks that this recombination experiment should be done in human cells expressing human endogenous viruses like HERVK. XMRV can cause pathogenic changes in mice. Lipkin found retroviral sequences in 85% of ME/CFS patients, and Coffin generated novel replication-competent retroviruses related to XMRV in 10 days. In February of 2014, the American Society for Microbiology published an article on the effectiveness of alcohol-based disinfectants to prevent XMRV contamination. The concluding sentence of their abstract states, "Their applications will help to prevent unintended XMRV contamination of cell cultures in laboratories and minimize the risk for laboratory personnel and healthcare workers to become infected with this biosafety level 2 organism." In the article's concern about the risk to healthcare workers, one can almost hear the echoes of the original 1934 to 1935 outbreak of ME/CFS among the doctors and nurses of Los Angeles County General Hospital. As for Mikovits, she is like her former research assistant, Max Post, a person that science does not seem to want. The legal battles with the Whittemores left her financially devastated, and the research grants, which would have enabled her to continue her investigations at another institution, were taken away from her. She still has not received copies of her notebooks or those of the team she led at the WPI for nearly 5 years. It is as if Darwin, having sailed around the world for 5 years on the Beagle, collecting his samples and making his notes, published his theory of evolution, only to have the Church of England swoop in and take all of his materials away, then feign surprise that he couldn't keep working on his theory. One can only speculate why those in positions of power in science have not demanded that her notebooks be returned. And yet, Mikovits continues to go to conferences and follow the latest scientific research. She has formed a company with Frank Rossetti, MAR Consulting Incorporated, so that they can consult with physicians, patients, companies, and academic institutions. For Mikovits, it has always been and will always be about the patients. Mikovits wonders whether science will continue to dismiss and dehumanize the patients, severing those unmistakable connections and not following hopeful leads. Or will the NIH and other government agencies finally welcome the great insights of patients and researchers? The question which Mikovits continues to ask, the question which urgently needs to be answered, is whether the plague feared by Coffin and Stoy has already arrived, but we do not recognize it. As Mikovits and Rossetti have often said to each other over the years, they see what they want to see, and that is the real plague. This has been an Audible Studios production of Plague, One Scientist's Intrepid Search for the Truth About Human Retroviruses and Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, ME/CFS, Autism, and Other Diseases. Written by Kent Heckenlively, J.D., and Judy A. Mikovits, Ph.D. Narrated by Eric Martin. Producer, Mike Charzuk. Copyright 2014 by Kent Heckenlively and Judy Mikovits. Production copyright 2014 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.